Dr. Herbert Weisinger, formerly Dean of the Graduate School at Stony Brook, in his condominium in Sarasota, March 21st, 1987.
That's right, 87. I can't believe it happened.
I know.
Do you want to hear how I happened to come to Stony Brook?
Well,
is that of any interest?
It certainly is. Now, I'd like to follow these questions for a while, then I've got some more questions for you.
Right. My name is Herbert Weisinger. I came to Stony Brook as chairman of the Department of English in 1966. Then a year and a half later, I became dean of the graduate school, a position which I held for 10 years. At that time, administrators retired when they reached the age of 70. 65, yes, of course. And retirement from the university was at 70. So I had 5 years in the English department after I retired as dean. I retired in 1982. So let's see, I was at Stony Brook almost as long as I was at Michigan State, from which I had come. I came to Stony Brook in 66. I was born in 1913, so that means I was 53 at the time. I came from Michigan State, where I had been professor of English, chairman of the Department of Comparative Literature, more precisely the program in Comparative Literature, and editor of the Centennial Review. Who was primarily responsible for you coming to Stony Brook? That's an interesting question. I was at In 1965-66, I was Burke Professor of English at NYU. It was a visiting professorship. I had in my class then a young man who was instructor, in one of my classes, a young man who was instructor in English at Stony Brook, and he asked the department to invite me out for a talk. After I gave the talk, I was virtually interviewed for a position I didn't know existed, which was the chairman of the Department of English. I also knew Alfred Kazin, who had come out to Michigan State to lecture and visited us at our house. And at that time, the department had no permanent chairman and was looking for somebody to take the position. I have to laugh because I didn't know until after I came there that the English department was regarded as a tiger and that people around were wondering who was going to put his head in the cage. I had been at Michigan State for 24 years. I'd reached the point where I had all the perks that full professors get, I could have stayed on, of course. But having gone to New York, I also realized that we were missing something of the excitement of proximity to a big city. We found that Stony Brook was a beautiful place physically. Yeah. I had no idea. It's true, people would say to me, oh, you've come back home. I said, oh, no, I'd never been to the North Shore of Long Island. That was for young people. When I was growing up, that was not forbidden territory, but one didn't go there. And we found that quite beautiful. And I had received offers from other institutions to go as a professor, but I have to confess now that like all teachers, I nourished the illusion that somehow or the other, if I were chairman, I could do a better job. It's a very deceptive one, but if you've been at it long enough, you get that conviction. And Stony Brook struck me as a wonderful opportunity. It was a growing institution, had money. I knew it was going to be a major research institution. And the opportunity to help build that was virtually irresistible. I should also say that there was a sentimental reason, though not the major one, but still a strong one. When I got out of Brooklyn College in 1934 and wanted to go to graduate school, there was no state institution available. The only places I could go to were NYU or Columbia or any of the private schools, and I simply couldn't afford to go there. As it turned out, it was cheaper for me to go to Ann Arbor, the University of Michigan, and live away from home than it was to stay in New York at home and pay tuition. So I felt, gee, it's a good feeling to be able to come back and give students of that generation what my generation didn't have.
Yes.
Maybe it's sloppy sentimental, but it's true.
No, I think it's pragmatism.
It was a very strong feeling on my part. Anyhow, I came to Stony Brook. It was a hard decision to make. My wife was in business. We had built the house we had dreamed of. We had friends from, I don't know, from 24 years.
Mm-hmm.
People asked me, why did you become chairman of Michigan State? That's the people at Stony Brook. I said, you can't be chairman in a place where you have to tell friends that well, you have to deal with your friends in the position of being a chairman. I just couldn't bring myself to do it. I said, I have no trouble with you people because I don't know you. And I can deal with you objectively. I didn't find the department a tiger. There were difficulties, but then all departments are difficult. And it was marvelously exciting. Two things. One was building the department. First person I hired was Louis Simpson. Everybody thought that the first person I hired would be a dry-as-dust scholar. But I had always known about Louis. Known him. And he was just the combination of a scholar-poet that I wanted. So,
that was a good appointment.
Yeah, he was a great appointment to have. And then I had others. I tried to get the department to get out of the straight English-American literature syndrome. And so I got people who were interested in theology and people interested in science. Essentially, it was a comparatist approach. And we enjoyed it very much. I recruited like mad. There were times when I couldn't bear the thought of another dinner at the Three Village Inn. But the other thing that was so exciting is we had money to bring in visitors to stay a week. We could put them up for a week and they
at Sunwood.
At Sunwood or wherever else. Live with students. We brought in poets and critics and scholars. And the students found that.
Can you mention a few of those?
Sure. The best-known one was Kenneth Burke, who was there twice, and who also went down to Suffolk Community College.
O'Connor Cruz or Temple Graham?
No, O'Connor Cruz came out because, that's ironic, because I brought him out to be interviewed for the deanship of the graduate school. I didn't know that I was going to get the job. I had known Connor at NYU. At the time that I was Bird professor, he'd just been appointed Schweitzer professor. We lived in the same building and got to be friends with him. And I thought he'd make a great dean, but apparently Johnny felt that we should not take the Schweitzer professor from NYU. That didn't prevent the privates from taking our people. But Johnny had an odd punctiliousness about these things. So that fell through, and then we had any number of poets come through and stay, and the students found that particularly exciting. So what was interviewing candidates and what was the poets and critics around, there was never a dull moment. And I enjoyed that part of it tremendously. I was always introducing people in talks.
You brought in one man from Harvard, Levin.
Well, Harry Levin,
yes.
Right. Harry would have come if we could have offered him a Schweitzer chair. He had a name chair at Harvard, and that meant a lot to him. And indeed, Johnny offered him everything he had at Harvard without the name professorship. But Harry had a great deification with Harvard. It won't go into the history books. I remember Alfred Kazin telling me, if Levin comes, he goes, but the issue didn't arise. They had not gotten along well.
I see.
But that was a decision I would have to make when the time came. I had a very clear notion what the decision would be. But, so we couldn't get a Schweitzer professorship because we had the Einstein. I thought it was, again, a little silly because to build a university, you get the people you want and don't worry about all these kinds of rules and regulations. My feeling of the matter was that the other institutions couldn't recruit people of the caliber Harry Levin. That was their hard luck, not mine. But as it turned out, we couldn't do it. You know, the great villain was always Albany. If you couldn't do anything, it was Albany.
Albany's fault. Yeah.
Always Albany's fault. Anyhow,
right.
After a year and a half, when Bob, what was his name, who was acting dean of the graduate school, went to the University of Washington, the position came over.
Bob Jordan.
They interviewed, and as I said, I brought in Connor. And then to my utter and complete surprise, the position was offered to me. I really did not think about it. I didn't even know I was being considered. And to this day, I'm convinced that the reason I was offered the deanship of the graduate school was that I was the soft throne to the humanities and social sciences. Because all the other administrators, Sidney had not yet been appointed, you know. The other major administrators, at least the three major administrators, were scientists, Johnny and Alec and Benjamin, at the time. And I guess there may have been repercussions. And so the position was offered to me. And I have to confess that if I ever had an academic dream, it was to be dean of graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
It happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed every moment of it for 8 years. The last 2 years were difficult.
Mm-hmm.
When the cornucopia closed, it became difficult.
Mm-hmm.
As Albany tightens up.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you know, 10 years is a long time to be dean. I discovered the average life of a graduate dean is about 3 years. So
like a president.
Yeah, I outlived my usefulness 3 times. But through that position, I got to be a member of the GRE board and on other committees of the graduates, deans.
GRE, graduate record?
Yes, I was a member of that board for 4 years. I represented that board on a number of other graduate committees. And I was also active in the Council of Graduate Schools.
Mm-hmm.
I helped found the Northeastern group of Council of Graduate Schools.
Mm-hmm.
I was pretty active in graduate school affairs outside of the Stony Brook, which gave me a very good perspective on what was going on.
Yeah.
Who interviewed me for the position? Well, there was nobody per se in the English department except the whole gang of them. The actual offer was made to me by Dudley. I don't suppose this will occur in the history, but in those days, Dudley had a great desire to offer everybody an acting position. And I said, no way, I'm not going to go into that situation with an acting position because that's being a lame duck before you start. So but he acceded to that. I saw Johnny, at least I think I saw Johnny, but I'm not altogether sure. Essentially, it seemed to be when the department said, okay, and it seemed to be between Bentley and me. He conducted all the negotiations. I don't even, who is this again? It was, I guess, was he dean?
Bentley was,
he was vice president.
Vice president for academic affairs.
But I was thinking of the man who went to Texas.
Stan Ross.
I interviewed him, but I didn't have the sense that he had the final word. And Ross was an interesting character, all right.
I appointed him.
Did you?
About 4 months after I got on the job.
Oh.
I came as acting head and dean of arts and science.
Yeah, I see. Now, I forget what Stanley's position was. It was an odd title.
He was dean.
Yeah, but then he got something else. when he had some offer, Johnny created a position which never lasted after Stanley left. It doesn't matter. But it seemed to me that the negotiations were done by Bentley completely. The offer, the position, the finances, or whatever arrangements were made. So I had to go back to Michigan State for a half a semester to finish up our obligation, because it was all rather sudden. And so I came in, I guess it was either November or December of that year.
About 66.
66, yeah. And immediately plunged into recruitment. It so happened that year MLA was taking place in New York, and we went, and since I wanted to know the department, I got myself a suite, and everybody in the English department was there all the time. In fact, I remember interviewing candidates in the bathroom, because there was no room and no quiet in the living room, because everybody was there talking to each other and drinking coffee and whatnot. Because I realized very quickly that one of the things the department lacked was a sense of itself as a group of people in a common enterprise. And so Mildred and I gave many parties.
That was a pretty general situation throughout the university.
I didn't like the fact that people lived in New York. I couldn't keep them from living in New York. I did say to a number of people who wanted to come, who were at NYU, for example, at Columbia, but who wanted to remain in New York, and these were, Eric Bentley was one of them. But they wouldn't come out, and I said, no, I won't have it. And I tried to make a condition of employment, which of course was impossible, that if you did get a job at Stony Brook, you lived in the area, because I wanted students to have access.
Right.
Plus, one or two people said yes, did live there, and then moved into the city. Nothing you could do about it. But I felt that very strongly. Let's see, I said...
I think you're down to...
I'm up to seven.
Yes, you're up to seven.
Seven is a good good question. I thought of Stony Brook as a major research institution in a state that needed a state-supported major research institution. I didn't think that Buffalo, or certainly not Albany, and very problematically Binghamton were ever going to be that. But I thought Stony Brook had the potential, which is one reason why I came.
It had the model, certainly, in the science area.
Yes.
Virginia.
I assume that because it was a comprehensive state university, it was going to build up just as well as the other fields.
Yes.
And I think in some areas it did. Of course, our model, not a model, I guess either way, a rival would be University of California at La Jolla, which was begun at the same time, had very strong science very quickly. I'm not sure that they did as well in the social sciences, the humanities. They certainly didn't do as well as the sciences.
No.
I think in the sciences they did better than we did. In the humanities and social sciences, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure that they did. The potential was great. The location was wonderful.
Yeah.
It was beautiful. It was 60 miles from New York, which is, when you're young, practically nothing, you know. So we did build up some departments that I have great pride in. Music is one.
Mm-hmm.
We did very well in music. I can put it more negatively. We didn't do well in the languages at all.
Mm-hmm.
We did poorly in art, which struck me as very sad, because art could have done what music did, was to relate to both New York City and the Hamptons, the East End.
Right.
But they never could make it. The other one that didn't make it, and I don't know whether they still ever have, was theater.
Mm-hmm.
And for the same reason, they couldn't relate it. Music took advantage of its location.
Yes.
But the other departments...
Was this Billy Jim?
Billy Jim, yes.
Billy Jim
came at the same time. He and I came at the same time. But he recognized the potential because he had that kind of academic imagination. I think one of the problems with music and art, with art and theater, was the influence of the man. It seems to me when I came there, there was one department that encompassed all these fields.
John Newfield.
Yes, well, I don't want to speak ill, but Newfield was too vain to have people of quality around him. Well, I can only go by the result.
I heard that.
Because this is where you go by. It doesn't matter what people say or what they look like. You go by performance. And he never recruited, never attracted top-rate people the way Billy Jim did.
You're dependent very heavily on department chairmen.
That's right. And what departments don't realize is that administrators see departments as a lengthening shadow of the chairman. And if they send up to you as their representative, a guy for whom you can't conceive any respect, then you say to yourself, what kind of department is it that wants this man to represent them?
Well, John had been there before I came. And in those days, we had multiple disciplinary departments.
Yes, I know.
We had to begin with.
Yes, but you see, I ran into him rather quickly with as chairman of the English department. Mm-hmm. He was not interested in the kind of graduate research work that I was. And it was very difficult to cooperate with him. Mm-hmm. Even in the multidisciplinary field that he represented, I did come to Stony Brook with some reputation in comparative literature. And I had been a senior research fellow at the Warburg Institute. I knew something about art.
Which institute? Senior research fellow?
At the Warburg Institute of the University of London.
I see.
I was there for 2 years.
I see. Warburg.
Warburg.
I see. Warburg.
Probably the finest art historical institute in our time. Kassira came from there, Panofsky came from there, mm-hmm. Soxel came. It was a great opportunity for me. So I knew something about the comparative method. Mm-hmm. I was myself always interested in music, and it was delightful to be with Billy Jim. Mm-hmm. You know, we spoke the same language.
That's good.
And, but Newfield, I'm afraid, didn't. I think those three departments suffered. But music really took off.
Well, Sam Baron has been a tremendous influence.
Yes, he comes down here.
Does he really?
Oh, yeah. He comes down not this year, but he comes down regularly for our spring festival, our summer festival. And Timothy Eddy comes down.
Uh-huh. Great Greenhouse.
And yes, he hasn't come down lately, but they're on the faculty this summer. It's our little Aspen.
Yeah,
it's quite good.
Uh-huh.
And
down here in Sarasota.
They give six concerts in June on successive weekends. Mm-hmm. And Mary and I subscribe to them. Get a great variety of chamber music.
Must be the early June because the Bach Aria Festival is the last 2 weeks in June now.
Yeah, well, but Sam comes in the first part.
I see.
It's the first 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. So there's no conflict. But this year I see he's not scheduled. But so we did very well. You know, one of the things as dean of the graduate school is you do have. I'm never quite sure what the dean of the graduate school does. And I took over that job and went to meetings with my colleagues from other institutions. I found an enormous variety of responsibilities. There was no one such thing as a dean of a graduate school. And, some of them had tremendous authority, it was just a nice position. I was lucky because, the first thing I did when I became dean is I got hold of the assistantships. And all those assistantships belonged to my office. And when one fell vacant, they came back to my office. So that I had a talking point, to put it mildly, with the department chairman.
Yes.
I was surprised that my successor gave that up. because you know, when
who is your successor?
The chemist. I forgot what. I think he stayed here. He came from Rochester.
Funny.
I forgot his name completely.
Ross?
No. He was a chemist.
Yeah.
Okay.
Gross?
No. I think there have been 4 genes since I left the table. So the average is evening out. But he gave up that. And you know, when all is said and done, if you reduce academic life to its reality, it's the flow of money that counts.
That's right.
And the man who answers the telephone has the authority. And since I control that flow, I can have some input into what was going on. Because without it, it's a very nice position, but it's meaningless. I finally decided that my job was to see to it that our graduate students got the best possible education of which we were capable. I did not regard it as my role to worry about faculty needs as such. There were other deans who took care of that. But I persisted in seeing everything through the eyes of the graduate students, which got me into a lot of difficulty with chairman. It also at the same time enabled me to evaluate what was going on. What people wouldn't understand is that it's true I didn't know anything about sociology, but I knew enough people in administrative positions at other institutions and enough people of consequence elsewhere where several phone calls you could get a pretty damn good fix. Also,
pretty damn good what?
Fix on how good a department was,
yeah.
As distinguished from what they told you.
Yes.
Because I soon discovered that every department told me it was the best. Well, that was very nice, because if every department was best, none was best. So you started all over again. But by virtue of the fact that I conducted reviews of every department every 5 years by outside consultants.
Good.
And even those I didn't like, because they tended to be guild reports. Because if the department nominated interviewers, the evaluators, you had to be a little suspicious.
Right.
If I did it, they were suspicious, so we compromised. But then I was on the committee of SUNY that instituted the Regents evaluation. And indeed, the practice and criteria came very much from Stony Brook. People are not aware of that.
Well, initially, Dave Fox and I wanted to make sure that when we went into graduate work, we were not criticized for going beyond our capacity, exceeding our abilities. We already had, when I came in 62, we already had graduate work in chemistry and physics improved. But when biology came up, I insisted we get some outside people to
take a look. I continued that practice for every department.
That's good.
Every 5 years.
We were never turned down while I was there.
No.
For an application for graduate work.
No, no. And none within the 10 years that I was there.
Yeah.
But we did present our cases, and I didn't present them a number of cases which I wouldn't present. Incidentally, I mean, it's not common knowledge, but because I didn't want it to be. But I simply refused to submit the papers.
Well, I remember the English department wanted to go into PhD work. I had a committee of Marjorie Nicholson.
Oh, yes.
And Bill Dix was the librarian at Princeton. And one other person I've forgotten. I forgot his name. I think he came from NYU. And they made it quite clear that they didn't think that the department was ready for
PhD
work.
In fact, when I came, before I came to Stony Brook, papers had been put in and an interviewing committee, an evaluation. I came from Michigan State to be there for that. As it turned out, I knew everybody on the committee. And it made a difference, I think, because we did get the program approved. But what was most important is when the Board of Regents decided to evaluate all graduate programs in the state, public and private, I was in on that from the very beginning. And I participated in every session. And I knew exactly what was thought of every graduate program that we did before my retirement in every school in the state. And that was really where the chips were down, to say.
Albany suffered.
Pardon me?
Albany suffered.
Well, I was in a particularly difficult position because I represented SUNY. Not Stony Brook, but I sat on that board as SUNY, and I would not support Albany for obvious reasons.
My son is associate professor in the music department at Albany.
I see. Well, it's different now.
He just had a 100-page paper approved for publication in Anglo-Saxon England.
Oh, really? That's good.
He's research interests are origins of many musical notation.
Uh-huh. That's great. But, you know, Albany wasn't like that.
Yeah.